How many in this class have never studied the Song of Solomon? Everybody studied the Song of Solomon. So everybody knows what it's about. The Song of Solomon is a love story. It's a song. It centers on a young woman, a Shulamite young woman. She's an outdoors girl. She doesn't consider herself very pretty, but the king does. And a shepherd boy does. It's a triangle. And so the king wants to make this girl a part of his harem. He has a lot to offer: money, palace, servants, fame, all of those things that you may think would be important. But the shepherd has none of that to offer. He's just a commoner, cannot offer her a palace or servants or riches. But the difference is, she loves the shepherd boy with affectionate love, we'll see in our study today. And he loves her. And so as you go through the song, there's these dialogues that go back and forth, some of them in the Shulamite maiden's mind. But it's a great song eulogizing the purity and the beauty of affectionate love. We can only touch on it tonight because of time, but we can glean some lessons from it that will be beneficial to us since we're studying a lesson on affectionate love. If you have your Bibles open, look at chapter 1, verse 2. I've got some verses there on your lesson. These verses serve to show that it is the love of affection, of feeling, of emotion, and that it is a love based on delight in the other person. We talked about caring love that is not a love of emotion. In fact, sometimes must rise above emotion and always seeks the good of the other person because it esteems their value. This is different. And so look at chapter 1, verse 2. May he kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. So here's a love that seeks romance. Verse 7, tell me, O you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? That is this shepherd boy that she's in love with. Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? In other words, I'd like to be with you. I'd like to be sharing your life, the idea of companionship. In chapter 2, verse 4, he has brought me to his banquet hall. His banner over me is love. Sustain me with raisin cakes. Refresh me with apples because I am lovesick. And so here's this affectionate love. By the way, just a passing point on the words themselves. The King James says, I'm sick of love. And the word love in the Septuagint version, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, is agape, which often we're here is the highest kind of love. Well, it's not here. It's affectionate love. I'm love sick. And so in chapter 3, as she thinks about him, on my bed night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city and the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I did not find him. The watchman who made the rounds in the city found me, and I said, have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I left them when I found him. Him whom my soul loves. I held on to him and would not let him go till I'd brought him to my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. And on these other verses, we'll not read them all, but they're along that same line. You can see that there's a strong, affectionate feeling of the woman for this shepherd boy, and throughout the psalm, he too has that love for her. Now, this love is based on delight in the object, in the person loved. And look in chapter 4. First six verses. This is Solomon. And you'll see that what he's looking at is that to him she's pretty. Now when you read these, you won't think necessarily these are phrases that you'd use to tell somebody they're pretty. But that's what they are. How beautiful are you, my darling? How beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. So Lily, if some guy comes up and says, boy, Lily, your hair is like a flock of goats. You think, what? But to these people, that's saying it's very pretty, very full. And your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn sheaves, which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one among them has lost her young. Apparently a pretty set of teeth. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones, on which are hung 1,000 shields, all the round shields of the mighty man. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. And so you see the idea as he talks about her physical appearance. Solomon, she's very attractive. Now, that's not sinful. That's not wrong for Solomon to think she's pretty. Just want you to see this is the kind of love that's in view based on delight in the object love. Now, look in verse 7 following. This is the shepherd, as he describes her, that is in the bride's mind. As she thinks about the shepherd, this is what she knows that he treasures in her. And you'll see that he too appreciates her physical beauty, but there's more. You are altogether beautiful, my darling. So as the bride thinks about the shepherd, this is what she would see him saying to her. And there's no blemish in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. May you come with me from Lebanon. Journey down the summit of Amana, from the summit of Sinar and Hermon, from the dens of lions, from the mountains of leopards. Note, what's he offering her? Let's run the fields together. Let's have a good time together. You think Solomon's going to have any time for that? Nah. He's got these hundreds and hundreds of wives. He's a king in the kingdom. But this shepherd boy said, let's go to the mountains. Spend some time together. You have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. Sister doesn't mean a physical relationship of sister. Remember, these are Hebrews speaking. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. You can just see two people in love, and one looks at the other's eyes, and it just sets their heart a beating. That's this. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils, than all kind of spices. Is this some perfume she wears, maybe? I don't know, possibly. You'll see in verse 9 that he does notice her attire, her necklace. And so he's impressed with that. And by the way, men, you know, do you ever talk to your wife this way? You ever notice what she's wearing? How her eyes look, how her appearance is, and talk to her about it. Has that quit since you got married? But to her, this is very precious. He says, your lips, my bride, verse 11, your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. It could be the things she says to him, the way she speaks to him, could be her kisses. In either case, it's something about her that brings him great pleasure, delight. The fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon. But now here's something really different. verse 12. Now, you've already seen some differences. He wants to just spend time together. Be her companion. Verse 12, a garden locked is my sister, my bride. A rock garden locked. A spring sealed up. Your shoots are orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits. Henna with nard plants, nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon. With all the trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, along with the finest spices. You are a garden spring full of fresh water and stream flowing from Lebanon. So here's the picture. Here's this beautiful, beautiful garden. It has the spices that they treasured. And some of the women here treasure too now, all these essential oils. But they were considered very precious. Beautiful spring, fresh water, beautiful flowers blooming. There's that beautiful garden. But he can't get in. He can't get in to touch the flowers, drink the water, because the garden's locked. She's saving herself. Remember the story we told about the roses? She's saving herself. And in her mind, he values that, and that means something to her. I just suggest that we teach our young people, especially our young girls. Might give them a key, for example. Say, this is the key to your heart and your body. You save it for one person. One person. Yes, Ennis? Yes. That's a good point. Yes, it's important the boys appreciate this purity in a girl. And if a young man's thinking right, that will be very important. Very important. And so this is the picture of the love and why this love exists between the two of them. All right, so you might say, well, some girls and some women just can't be physically pretty. And certainly once they get married and they begin to age, all of physical beauty doesn't necessarily stay with them. They may still stay attractive. But there'll be changes taking place in their body and their face and their hair and so forth. But can a woman still be beautiful to her husband, especially if he's a godly man? Certainly. The character traits of chastity and godliness and loyalty and sensibleness and responsibility can make her more beautiful than those models that walk across the stage to a godly man. And so a woman can retain her beauty. 1 Peter 3 talks about that very thing. The character traits that do not fade with time, imperishable traits. And men and women that have been married for many years and have cultured their relationship love their wife very deeply because they've come to appreciate the woman they are. Not just that they look good, but the woman they are. Well, what about men? Same thing with men. Went back, this girl treasured her young man and thought he was very handsome. There's statements in this song where she talks about how looking verse 10 of chapter 5, my beloved is dazzling and ruddy, outstanding among 10,000. His head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven, etc., etc. But he's not going to stay looking that way. So what is there that men can do to continue to be attractive to their wives, to be desirous, to be pleasant to be with? Patience, kindness, consideration, leadership, loving leadership. You can think of other things. But remember, this love is not based on a command. It's a natural outgrowth of finding in somebody something that brings you pleasure and delight. So if you want this kind of love in your marriage, whose responsibility is to do something about it? Your own. To make yourself attractive if you can. Maybe you can't physically, but mentally, spiritually, morally, responsibly, making yourself, being a good companion, somebody your mate loves to just be with, to laugh with, to cry with, to share dreams with, and then you can nurture this relationship. Look on your survey that we gave you. On page 2 and on page 3, there's 11 rows on 2, 13 rows on 3. And the result of this survey is like on the page 2. You see on up there at the top, below is a list of ways that husbands might intentionally or unintentionally hurt their wives. Same thing when you turn the page. Things that wives may do, intentionally or unintentionally, that dishonor their husbands. And either the husband feels disrespected or he's hurt or it makes him mad or whatever, and same thing on page 1. So here's the point. If this love that we're talking about, this affectionate love, is based on, I like to be with you. You're a light in my life. What if, row 1, the woman frequently criticizes? What if, the woman said about the man, what if he frequently criticizes? And you can see that's row 1 on the next page, too. And then row 2, he analyzes your words instead of trying to understand your feelings. What if instead of doing that, you started trying, men, to really understand how your wife feels about things? That may be hard for a man sometimes because we may not be so emotional. But then on the very contrast, on that second row on page 2, she reacts emotionally to what you say instead of thinking through. What would it do for companionship if he felt like you weren't going to go into a crying fit or shouting fit or whatever it may be when you discuss things, when you differ? And you can go down this list. These are things real people wrote in. People like you and me. Things that bother them about their mates. Do you want to build affectionate love? If we understand it's built on the light in the other person, are these things that are on this sheet, would they threaten that? Think about that as you go over this survey. And so if affectionate love has died, or if it's just a barely little spark in your marriage, go over the list. Maybe there's something here. And what's the best way to go over it with your mate? That's why we have that checklist at the end of the lesson. And so tremendous useful lessons here in the Song of Solomon. There's a little refrain that's all the way through the song. I have it on your lesson. 2-5, 3-5, 5-8. It's a important little refrain. It really teaches us something. We've talked about it in class, and right here is the confirmation of it. In chapter 2, verse 7, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. So here are the daughters of Jerusalem, the women of Jerusalem. And they're saying, what's wrong with you, woman? Man, I wish he'd pick me for his harem. What are you waiting on? And they're trying to encourage her to take Solomon's offer. And so she says to them over and over again, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the hinds of the field, evidently animals known for their freedom, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until it or she pleases. In other words, you can't force it. That's what we've been talking about. You can't force it. It's got to arise naturally. And that's what you see in refrain after refrain. You go to chapter 3, 5, I adjure you, O daughter of Jerusalem, same thing, that you'll not arouse or awaken my love until it pleases. You can talk about the king and his riches and his harem and his glory. Look, this love's not based on that. You can't force it. What a lesson. You can't force your mate's love. You can't do it. We talked about that in a previous class. But what you can do is try to be delightful. And to find out what that is, sit down and communicate. We talked about that early on in our study, didn't we? So, you know, Robert Rice is here. If Robert Rice gets out in the morning and his car won't start, Robert has an idea where to start looking. Maybe you start with the battery. Say, well, let's see if the battery's okay. And first, maybe you look at the gas gauge. You've got to have gas to run. And maybe he'll look at something else. In other words, Robert knows what makes a car work because he knows what makes it work. If it's not working, he knows how to start trying to fix it. Now, there's other people maybe in this class that the car don't start. Where's the number to AAA? That's about all I know to do. And that's the way sometimes people do when they're married. Where's the preacher's number? Where's the elder's number? And sometimes you need help. But the point is, if you can know how this love works, what makes it work, now you can start trying to fix it. And hopefully that's a benefit of our study. Any comments or questions? Before I go to the next lesson, look down at the checklist. There are just two or three or four of them I want to look at with you. Look at number three on the checklist. Do you scoff at showing affection, tenderness, and warmth to your wife and simply expect her to fulfill your sexual needs upon demand? I know, I'm not hypothetical. I know for a fact that this is a problem in marriages. Some that we tried to work on that didn't make it. Talk to your wife, fellas. Number four, do you talk to your husband? Touch your husband. And generally treat your husband in such a manner as to encourage warmth and tenderness. How do you treat him when he gets home from work? How do you touch him? Look at number six. Have you forgotten what it means to be a woman? Do you work at being feminine, lovable, and desirable to your husband? Do you wear the kind of clothes, you know, he likes and fix your hair like he likes it and otherwise adorn yourself to make yourself attractive to your husband? Well, instead, I don't have to do that. We're married. You have to suck it up. Okay? Go ahead. And he may suck up his love, too. Number seven, how do you treat your mate when you were courting? What did you do, man, when you were courting? Women, when you were courting? Why? Why did you do what you did? What was the result? I guess it resulted in you getting married. Somewhere along the line, you did something, right? Did you like it? Did you like courting? Why does it have to change? Why does it have to change? Jeff mentioned that the other day. I believe it was after class. You pointed that very thing out. So why can't we keep on dating? Anyway, these are the kind of things we're just trying to encourage thought with. Hopefully you'll sit down and look at the list and maybe discuss it with your mate. Okay, we've got about 18 minutes to at least get in part of this lesson on intimate love. Now, we talked about the fact there's three kinds of love. One is caring love. Would somebody please briefly describe it for me?
Concerned about
seeks the other person's well-being. That's right. Cares about them and seeks their well-being. Suppose they don't even like to be with them. What?
It's
not based on feeling, not based on their beauty. You still care about them and you seek them. Give me the highest example of this kind of love.
Sacrifice
of Christ. That's right. Sacrifice of Christ on the cross. No greater love than this. A man laid down his life, his friend. God so loved the world. And that's the love of neighbor. Love your neighbor. How? As yourself. That's caring love. All right. Then we just got through talking about affectionate love. Different? Yes. Not commanded. Beautiful in a relationship, but based on the light in the other person. Is affectionate love always good? No. I think I skipped Solomon. 1 Kings 11. Solomon loved many foreign women, the text says. Did we talk about that? Look at 1 Kings 11. Did he love them or not? The Bible says he did. Did he care about them? Sir? One food and shelter. If he really had the highest caring love, what would he have done? Would he have built them idols? Yeah, he'd have talked to them about the one true God, but instead he built them idols. He was in love. That wasn't good for them. If he'd have cared about them, he's the wisest man on earth. He said, look, let me explain to you why these idols don't amount to anything. No, he built them idols. And so, he held fast to these in love at the end of verse 2. What happened, verse 3, end of the verse?
Turned his heart away.
Our songs, the movies, Hallmark, portray if his love is good. No, it may not be good. There may be a forbidden love. Solomon shouldn't have married these foreign women in the first place. People fall in love with their neighbor's wife and they have no right to her. That's a forbidden love. And it can destroy people. Remember the story of Solomon. Wisest but most foolish man on the earth. Isn't that interesting? He didn't let his wisdom direct. We can sit here and study all of this. You can learn it all. But if it doesn't translate into the decisions we make every day, it doesn't do us any good. So we're going to talk about intimate love. Look at Proverbs 5. We're going to come back to Proverbs 5 later. All I want to do is show you on the first two kinds of love. We open to verses that actually use the word L-O-V-E, and the context around it helps define its nature. Well, we do that with this love. This is a love that has to do with the physical impulses, the biological differences and desires between men and women, its climax in the marital act between a man and a woman. And this is intimate love. That's my term. You may have a better term. I could call it sexual love. The reason I don't is because the word sex in our society connotes oftentimes the indulgence of the passions without moral restraint. I have no concern about somebody calling it sexual love if it's understood that's not what the Bible is talking about. And so I just use the term intimate. It's very private. It's very unique. God intended it for a man and a woman who are lawfully married. Proverbs 5:19. Look at the verse. Here's the word love. It's actually loving, this verse. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. And then the last part uses the word love. Be exhilarated always with her love. You can see by the term breast, that stands for the body, part for the whole, that this is a physical love. Clear in the text. You don't need a dictionary to see that. You don't need a commentary to see that. You can see what he's talking about. The intimate relationship of a man and a woman. Now, this lesson is going to focus on intimate love. And there's a danger connected with that, in that we can lose sight of the importance of the interaction with caring love and affectionate love. While God intended men and women to enjoy this love, it must be ruled by caring love. If it's not ruled by caring love, it can be cruel and oppressive and an ordeal. Anything but what God intended. And if affectionate love is not pleasant, it becomes merely duty, not the enjoyable thing God intended. So while I'm not going to be talking as much about caring and affectionate love, understand, please, for this kind of love to reach the potential that God intended, it has to be ruled by caring love, and it needs to be integrated with affectionate love. How important is this love? Is Ann Landers still put articles in the paper? Or she, that passed?
Who?
Who, that answers it, I guess. You don't know? Is Dear Abby now? I don't know. Huh, she's still in the paper? These young folks just don't know. What paper? What's a paper? Okay. I said something to Todd one time about the Statler brothers. I said, who are they? I thought, poor guy. Man. Anyway, she used to have a column, and people would write in, you know, about their questions about life. And she made it, she said, she had a list of the 10 most common problems between husbands and wives. Number one and number two. Now, she listed 10, but here's number one and number two, back when she was doing the column at least. Sexual problem between husbands and wives was number one. Number two, cheating spouses. Men used to be the cheaters 9 times out of 10. She said now it's 50-50. Both sides. I don't know how long ago she wrote that. But if it was a problem when she wrote that article in the paper and people fed in, you can imagine what it is today. Lynn MacMillan is a marriage counselor. There's a practice. People come in for counseling. He asks them 5 questions. One of the 5 is this one. Is marital intimacy truly fulfilling to both of you? You know, if you had to start out with a couple and say, I'm going to pick 5 most important questions, would that be one of them? It is to him. In dealing with people day in and day out. So, you go down to the courthouse and you look at the divorce paper and you say, why do these people divorce? You're not going to find on the divorce papers dissatisfaction in marital intimacy. But because it's not on the papers doesn't mean that it's not a root and deep problem in marriages. Yes, sir?
They probably call it incompatibility.
They call it incompatibility. That's a good point, Ed, is that maybe what they do. Kind of a broad term. Now you see on number 2, this is one of the reasons you have so many problems in this relationship, because there's such warped ideas about it. We had suggested you discuss the common views held by coworkers, friends, schoolmates about this kind of love. I don't know if you did that. Maybe you're embarrassed to do that. I don't know. But there's all kind of wrong ideas. When I studied for the family many years ago, I read a book by Maribel Morgan. She would consider herself a Christian. I don't think we would, but nevertheless, her marriage was in trouble. And so she began to do a lot of research, try to find out what to do. And she finally focused on the idea that she needed to change herself and be the kind of woman her husband enjoyed being with, and that the sexual part of their marriage she needed to work on and restored her marriage. And she wrote it's an interesting book. But what's interesting to me about her book, although it had a lot of good things in it, you can see the carryover from her Calvinistic philosophy. Because she said in the book that the desire for this sexual relationship with a man is a holdover from our sinful nature. God allows it. It's okay. But it's because of the fall that we even have this. That is not true. And it gives it some kind of a taint, as if it's got a little shadow with it. That's not true. And then, of course, the idea that it's just for procreation. That's what you do if you want to have kids. Then there's the idea, especially, that in the generations past, I'm talking about some of you in this audience, your mother and dad, your grandpa and grandma, in their minds, they would engage in this, obviously, because you're here. But just to engage in it because it's fun. Because we just like it. What does it matter to you? You perverted? Godly people don't do that. That's a perverted concept. That it can't be just for pleasure. We'll see that the Bible, that God intends men and women to just enjoy it. Forget about the kids, having kids, that idea. And then on the other side, flip the coin, it's the idea that it's the only reason for marriage. That's the only reason to get married. Satisfy the passions. Your marriage probably won't last long if that's the case. And then, of course, it's the idea that this is the only kind of love. When people see love, that's what they think. That's not true. And that's the deceit of it. Look at Proverbs 7. We'll look at this passage a little bit more in a later lesson. But look at Proverbs 7:18. Here's why it's so deceptive. This word love, it's a great word, but it can be so deceptive. Here's this woman trying to seduce this young man. Note what she says in verse 18. She doesn't say, come on, let's go sin. Let's contaminate our souls. Let's go commit fornication. No. What does she say? Verse 18. Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Oh, that sounds so good. And it ends up in his destruction. Don't be deceived by the word. We've already learned that sexual love can be cruel and selfish. What story did we study that shows sexual love can be cruel and selfish?
Amnon and Tamar.
Amnon and Tamar. That's right. And it's very fickle. You notice it gone? It was off. Then he hated her. Here today, gone tomorrow. What if your marriage is built on it? And so, what we do learn is this. Turn back to Genesis 1. So Moses writes this book to get Israel off on the right foot. They've been surrounded by idolatry for 400 years. He's leading them out of bondage. He needs to give them some right concepts. And so the book of Genesis starts with God being the creator. What about male and female? 1:26. God said, let us make man in our own image, according to our likeness, and let them... Who's the them? Look at verse 27. The male and female are in his image. They're equal as far as being in the image of God. Equally important. Equally valuable. But he made not just a male. He made a female. And so now you go over to chapter 2 as Moses backs up. And verse 18, the man is alone. And God said it's not good for him to be, quote, alone. Somebody said, I didn't say lonely. Was he alone literally? No. And as the Holy Spirit has guided Moses' pen, he writes out of order chronologically in the next two verses. So here, all these animals came before Adam, and he named them all. And then you have the bottom line in verse 20. But for Adam, there was not found a helper suitable for him. And so God made a woman, brought her to the man. And then down in verse 24, they become one flesh. That's based on the sexual relationship. God made male. God made the female for the man. So God made, quote unquote, sex. Sex is not a bad word necessarily. God made it. It can be pure and holy. And so that's important to see. It can have a tremendous impact in families. I don't know what you parents do with your young people. We've got some young people in this class. Yes, Craig?
I'll answer that in just a second.
Huh?
I'll answer that in just a second, but I wanted to point out something about this chronological order. Chapter 1, verse 31, God saw everything He made, and indeed, it was very good. This physical relationship, as you had talked about, is very good. It's not for nothing that we should be ashamed of or feel bad about. And I know some Christians, decades past, that tried to train their daughters about how it was disgusting or, you know, they scared them away from it. They had to relearn some things when they got married, basically, to piece together their relationship.
That's right. The generation my wife and I grew up in, parents didn't sit down and talk to their children about this. You might ask them a question. They might give you a brief answer. And as our kids got older, and like my daughter began to ask questions, and we just start answering it right there in the car. Well, boy, here's her brother in the car. We didn't want them to be ashamed. It's nothing to be ashamed about. I want them to talk about this to us, because there's nothing to be ashamed about. And good point that Craig makes. And sometimes kids grow up with this concept that it must be something bad because mom and dad never talk about it. It's hush hush. I'm not saying it's the topic for the dinner table or when you invite guests over. I'm not saying that. I said it's intimate, it's private, but it's not shameful. And your children need to know that. And if we go back to Genesis 2, when you study this with them, do you show it? Look, God made us this way. God made us different, in spite of what society says today. And He made us to relate to one another, not only mentally and spiritually and socially, but physically. That's God's doing. So, you know, a question has to arise. If it's pure and holy, Craig talked about that verse, it's very good. How do we talk about this relationship? I know this for a fact. There are men who use filthy language in talking about it. Dirty, low stuff. How do you think that makes their wife feel? Maybe they hear it in the world or at work. Maybe they read it somewhere. Maybe it's part of their culture. I don't know. Shouldn't our speech be such that it lifts it up to the level that God made it? That is not something that's associated with a dark alley or a dark room with a red light. And so how does our speech, what do we do to elevate this to the position that God has made it? And I see my time is up. So we'll pick up with 1 Corinthians 7 when I get back, the Lord willing. I'm leaving town tomorrow, the Lord is willing. And we'll pick up with 1 Corinthians 7 and hopefully finish this lesson. Thank you very much.